underneath the concrete jungle of Kalamazoo. Radio Revolution, anarchy on the airwaves. Thursday nights at 7 o'clock. The People's Power Hour on 89.1 WIDR.
Now, he's a spoiled brat. Tried the nice guy who's nice to cooperate with the president.
Anarchy on the airwaves. Listen every Thursday evening at 7 o'clock for radical history, activist updates, news from around the world, state-smashing rhythms, and your calls. Thursday nights, Radio Revolution, the People's Power Hour on 89.1 WIDR.
And welcome. You're listening to the People's Power Hour here on 89.1 WIDR, Kalamazoo.
And today we're going to be speaking with Ian Levison in just a little bit. We're going to get him on the phone. Ian Levison is the author of several books.
The latest being Dog Eats Dog.
Yes, we're going to talk to him about that one, which came out just in October, I believe.
October 1st.
He's also written Since the Layoffs, which is kind of loosely based on Flint, Michigan, maybe?
It's set in Wisconsin.
Yeah. And then there's also another book called...
Working Stiff's Manifesto.
Exactly. So, we're going to be talking to him about the book and maybe about some other things. Some things about money, maybe. Perhaps.
About life.
Indeed.
Keep it tuned. You're listening to the People's Power Hour.
And here's a song.
Keep it tuned.
Thank you.
And welcome back. You are listening to the People's Power Hour here on 89.1 WIDR, Kalamazoo. And tonight we are speaking with Ian Levison. Ian Levison is the author of A Working Stiff's Manifesto, a chronicle of his struggle to find post-collegiate employment in all the wrong places. Since the layoffs, his novel about a factory worker turned hitman in a failing economy. And his newest book, Dog Eats Dog, is now finally available in the States from Bitter Lemon Press. Ian, welcome back to the People's Power Hour.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
No problem. So, tonight, first off, congratulations on finding that English language publisher. Last time you were on, we mentioned the book was only published in France. Can you tell us a little bit about that difficulty you ran into over there?
Oh, man. U.S. publisher is difficult. And my last book, Since the Layoffs, is really popular in France. Mm-hmm. So naturally, they picked it up. But, it's kind of a rough deal selling fiction in the United States. It's hard. Mm-hmm. And the French have much more of a literary tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you can just sell... And there were a whole festival of authors I was over there with last time who, English-speaking writers who had been able to sell their books much more easily in Europe. So I think it's a rough road trying to sell fiction in the United States, but fortunately, over time, you wait long enough, good things happen, I guess.
Indeed. So last time we talked, you mentioned that the publishing companies here in the States tend to have this cookie-cutter idea of what a novel should be, and that the French aren't so much concerned about that cookie cutter ideal. What do you think about your novels doesn't fit into that cookie cutter?
It's absolutely the same. It's not just in entire art sector, that's the way they market films, and everything is a particular demographic. And because you got most of the people who read in the United States are women over 35, you're going to get a lot more writing that's geared to that demographic. So, and I don't write for that specifically, it's kind of harder for male writers, I think, to get books about, working and specifically male life published.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure it's the same thing with films because everything's graduated, everything's kind of deviated towards 18-year-old. You're going to get a lot more films like that. And it's difficult to get things outside the popular demographic produced or published.
Mm-hmm.
So, it applies to pretty much all the arts.
Alrighty. In your words, what do you think Dog Eats Dog is about?
It's about the failure of systems.
Mm-hmm.
Americans have so much faith. I'll just give you the basics of the story. It's about a guy who's a prisoner, who's a lifelong felon, and he winds up, for a variety of reasons, in the home of a college professor, and they're chased by the bank robber is chased by a member, an FBI agent. So, and it's basically about the inside of these three systems, the law enforcement system, the correction system, and the educational system.
Mm-hmm.
And how they all basically produce a substandard product. That's the kind of theme behind the book, but I try to overlay a fairly interesting crime novel on top of that.
Mm-hmm. So that's generally what you were trying to say, is that our systems are failing?
I think that's absolutely the case. I think that we have a lot of completely misplaced faith in them,
mm-hmm.
but I think ultimately they are failing. The educational system is obviously a complete disaster. I think we're industrialized democracy, that produces such a disastrous level of science graduates, mm-hmm. that we can't even compete anymore. Our infant mortality rate's going up, our health system's failing. That's not really addressed in the book, but law enforcement, we're constantly arresting and convicting the wrong people. We're arresting 720,000 people for marijuana possession every year. Mm-hmm. We're jailing a lot of them. We have nearly 3 million people in jail in the correction system. So, and that's almost 1% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all systems that have really failed the American people at enormous financial expense. And so I think it's, you know, we should talk about it. that's my philosophy anyway. It should be discussed more. It should be more of a focus. But the way we are completely sliding downhill in those regards.
Definitely. Where do you think this faith comes from? I mean, does it come from the media itself? Why do people invest themselves in these systems that all seem to be in various states of entropy?
Yeah, absolutely comes from the media. I mean, we're convinced, I think that's really the point of the school system, is to kind of indoctrinate people with faith in the other systems. And we're indoctrinated with the idea that the legal system is fair. We're indoctrinated with the idea that the correction system, you know, cures people and sets them on the right path before they're released, despite recidivism statistics that are just through the roof. You know, I think that the media, once people get out of the school system, the media just take over the job. Just watching the debates, you know, there's so many things that we're expected to take for granted. Like in this country, I mean, the healthcare system, you watch these people, there are two people from supposedly opposing parties who sit there and discuss lowering our health insurance rates as a means of solving the healthcare crisis. When, in fact, healthcare and health insurance really have nothing to do with each other, but it's just so accepted by, you know, our thought. It's drilled into us by the media that we have to accept that. Health insurance is the only way to practice healthcare.
Yes.
Despite the fact that most other industrialized democracies don't do that.
Yes. It does seem to be an accepted, an assumed premise to the argument of health insurance.
Yeah, and I think to a certain extent we've become a fascist country because of it. And I know that sounds like, you know, completely left-wing, off-the-wall, hysterical jargon, but the fact is that fascism is really just a marriage of corporations and government, and that's essentially what's happened in the United States over the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen such an effective marriage of these two things that there really isn't much of a government left. Basically, most of our policy decisions are made by corporations.
Definitely. So I guess with all of these things in mind, do you think there's a growing audience for books and for media that don't indoctrinate one, that actually bring it up, kind of air that dirty laundry and stick it where Americans can actually see it? And I don't know.
Well, you know, times of stress like we're going through right now, like a banking disaster, the last banking disaster in 1929, that really created a labor movement, and it created a great deal of cynicism and questioning about the banks. And, you know, that was basically the birth of the IWW and all the other, like, very strong union movements that came up in Kansas and the Midwest that Woody Guthrie always sings about. And it was almost as a direct result of that, partly that and partly the Dust Bowl. And so when things like this happen, when people are thrown into positions of great financial stress as a result of government malfeasance, they generally turn to, they start questioning things. And so hopefully this is a time that people will actually use. The negative side of that is that they start becoming extremely manipulable by people like Hitler, you know, who took over Germany with that exact, because of the financial stress of the population at the time. So a certain element of the population is going to start veering towards hate and rage and look for an outlet to express it. But, I mean, there's always a good percentage of the people that start looking towards for answers and start asking questions. So hopefully, you know, we'll get a lot more interest in why the banking system did what it did, how that was allowed to happen.
Indeed.
No, I'm sorry. Pardon?
I said indeed. I was going to say that the tone of the book seems to be set by the main character. I guess it's kind of hard to call him the main character. It's kind of a shared trifecta. But by Dixon, the intelligent bank robber making his way to his dream in Canada, basically on the run, fresh off of a bank robbery. What was your inspiration for this character?
I don't know. I really kind of liked him. I think he just developed over a period of time. I don't think there was any particular... There was a guy I met in Alaska who I thought was... I was working as a crab fisherman in Alaska. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of felons and parolees who work up there. It's a good place to just hide. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, this guy was actually in the parole system, and they knew where he was. But he was very bright, and he'd robbed a bunch of banks. And he was a nice, funny guy. And I had the feeling that if he didn't make any money in Alaska, he was just going to go right back to doing that. Mm-hmm. So... Yeah, I guess it's more based on him, but there are a lot of major differences between... Dixon is a lot more cynical and quiet and hopeless than that guy was. Mm-hmm.
One of the character's shining moments was a conversation that he had with Elias, the lecherous college professor. It's when Elias asked Dixon, why do you rob banks? And the answer was this rail against Federal Reserve money, the ignorance that Americans possess regarding money. And you mentioned that Dixon is cynical and whatnot. Were those Dixon's words, or were those yours?
You know, I've always been very curious about the banking industry, and I actually wrote this about 5 years ago because mm-hmm. it went through this long publishing nightmare where I had to get it published in France first, and that you know, that obviously took a number of years. So I think I wrote this in like 2003, and it seems to have been, you know, quite prescient. Hopefully that might sell some of the books. Mm-hmm. But I've always been very curious about banks and like what they do, how this money all moves around. And if you start asking economists, and I have done so, none of them give you the same straight answer, and there just seems to be a lot of confusion about very basic questions about money. Mm. You know, how does it get from the bank to the mint? I mean, from the mint to the bank. Who arranges this transaction? Who's charged for this? Who gets the money when it's made? I mean, if you make money, you give it to somebody. I don't know. I'm always kind of curious about exactly what goes on here and all the stuff that's written on money. I mean, it's good conspiracy theory stuff. I mean, you can always point to the F's and the M's and all the little letters and treasury notes and bank, Federal Reserve note or whatever written on there. And you can always get some good conspiracy theories going. But basically, I'm sure there are legitimate answers for most of this, but it's very curious that nobody knows this because it's such a powerful element and, you know, it's such a basic question for any culture and society and an economy to answer.
And I think with the current presidential debate going on, when the candidates say things about the economy, everyone just sort of accepts that, you know, they're talking about the economy, and most Americans have this vague idea of what the economy really is, but the specific things, none of the candidates will answer that. No one will go into why Wall Street's failing, and I guess...
I mean, their unwillingness to assign blame to individuals is astonishing. You know, there were very clear, nameable individuals who were responsible for this. So the people who did the deregulation. You know, I saw this coming. I saw this coming 6 or 7 years ago because I live in North Carolina and I'm a carpenter and I make like $25,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And I got a flyer in the mail from a car dealership, a Lexus dealership, telling me that I was been pre-approved for a $70,000 car. And I'm like, if you're pre-approving me for a $70,000 car, the economy's got problems. Mm-hmm. You know, things are wrong. And it's you just look at basic stuff like that, and you can tell when things aren't right. Mm-hmm. Because back in the old days, you know, you earned money and then you bought something. But when you stop doing that, when you change that dynamic of and suddenly people who have jobs where they don't earn very much are capable of purchasing things that, you know, only rich people have had prior to that, you know there is a basic problem. Mm-hmm. What's going on there? Where is that money coming from?
Yeah, I think that can most easily be seen by the recent bailout of Freddie Mac, right?
Whatever.
Yeah, Freddie Mac.
But yeah, I mean, it's something that's been going on. The list of foreclosures in the local newspaper every week grows and grows. And so, yes, I don't think it's any surprise, really, that the main firms who provide loans for homes are going under. So I think, I guess my question is, you know, why doesn't anyone see those signs? Why aren't the politicians or the economists or the people who are supposed to be in charge somewhere? What's going on?
Yeah, it does make you wonder, because I think what's going on is that they are making some kind of profit out of this gigantic mess.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a legitimate reason. Like, if you're suddenly finding that you have access to millions of dollars after being, you know, middle class or lower middle class, you're not going to want to change that.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly all this money starts flowing in to people who you know, just aren't used to having it. And I mean, my first reaction, if you came up to me and offered me $1 million, wouldn't be to go, whoa, we got to change something. So yeah, I mean, I think all these people, the regulators, the economists, they all just looked the other way and thought, well, I'm getting my share of the gravy train.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there are specific individuals who are more responsible than others, obviously the Republican Congress. And just watching them pretend that it wasn't them is funny. It was funny enough.
Indeed. Or watching McCain pretend that somehow he is the underdog. He's going to bring the change and revolution that we need.
Where does that come from?
I don't know.
He gave up on Michigan, didn't he?
Yes, indeed.
You guys are on the ball.
Yeah, we showed him we know a little thing about economic collapse. I don't know. It seems to me like, I guess nobody is accepting the blame. Nobody's giving any sort of blame. And I think most Americans are letting it slide. So I guess what I really want to say is, you know, thank you for writing fiction that brings that up. Cause I don't know. I don't think I have an answer for any of that.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency to look at it like it's Hurricane Katrina. You know, it's just this random tragedy that came out of nowhere and just struck us. Whereas, in fact, we thought this one up and did it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think Paul Krugman saw it coming, and there were a lot of other economists who did. But, you know, not soon enough, and they didn't sound the alarm bell loud enough.
Indeed. Well, going back to the book, what a... Elias, I like the character, and he's this college professor. You wrote Working Stiff's Manifesto. You talked about your time after you got a degree. And so what inspired Elias? What's his deal?
Well, Elias and his father both basically coast off the educational system. And when I was in college, I saw some professors doing that. And I thought, they've obviously studied very hard to get the PhD or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, they really don't put any effort into their lives. You know, you can teach like 6 or 7 classes a week, work essentially 15 to 20 hours a week, make a full salary, and really just coast through your life. And so they put no effort into your job. If once you get tenure at a university, there's not a whole lot of motivation for some of these professors. So I just wanted to create a guy like that who basically, I mean, his father had just completely milked the system his entire life, and Elias was doing the same thing. And it was just kind of a look at the innards of the educational system from professors that I've talked to and, you know, people who have told me what goes on at university, especially smaller colleges. And so I just created one of these smaller colleges and created a character who's basically just a complete parasite on the system.
Mm-hmm. And was Elias a foil for Dixon? I mean, Dixon seems to be someone who's trying very hard but can never seem to actually catch a break. So were the two meant to be this sort of polarizing pair?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're kind of, there's one person who's, as you say, trying very hard and just having basically the worst luck possible, which is what I consider, you know, the poor element of U.S. society.
Mm-hmm.
They do try, you know, and there's nothing, there are no breaks available to them.
Mm-hmm.
And Lyons, rather, the college professor, is pretty much the opposite. He's well-born, and he's got pretty much everything handed to him.
Mm-hmm.
He was given his house. He was basically given his job. Everything's provided for him. So they kind of are polar opposites, yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess you could say it's kind of a class issue there.
Yes,
you're upper class, who's completely amoral, the upper class guy. And the lower class guy was moral, but he's had it kind of essentially beaten out of him.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And somewhere in this mix, we have Denise Lupo, the atypical detective story fed. What were you trying to say with, you know, this pot-smoking FBI profiler experiencing a crisis of faith with the Bureau?
Well, when I wrote that, this was right around the time the Bureau was having a lot of problems as a result of 9/11. And I became very interested in their history. The way the FBI functions, it's very much a bureaucracy. It's a bureaucracy first, and it's effective crime organization, the crime-fighting organization second. And so it was really kind of a look at how bureaucracy just crushes somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And her being a woman, the FBI is notoriously sexist.
Mm-hmm.
Up until recently, it was racist as well. It was very difficult for black agents to get promoted. I think that most of that has changed now, but I'm sure it's still as sexist as any other corporation. And so I wanted to give a picture of somebody who is just completely demoralized by bureaucracy after going in there being very idealistic.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that her foil is in the young, attractive male agent, Cole, I think his name was. Were you trying to do the same thing with Elias and Dixon, or were you just trying to show with Cole as an example how the FBI used to be this racist, sexist bureaucracy?
Doing the same thing, just on a much more minor scale, because a much more minor character. But that is pretty much the polar opposite. That's what her career would have been like had she been a male.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it just serves as something that frustrates her even more when she looks at that.
Gotcha. Okay, so this is an interesting question. Which of the characters, Dixon, Elias, Denise, who's the real protagonist in this book?
Yeah, as you said, I think that it was really, it's really the bank robber. It's basically a story about the bank robber. And it's a story about, you know, I think he more than anything represents the average American.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the failure of systems. It's about the failure of the correctional system, the educational system, and the legal system,
mm-hmm.
all of which have played a part in his life, and none of which have done anything but harm.
And
I think that, you know, the book's statement really is that these we think so highly of these systems,
mm-hmm.
and they are not beneficial to most people, and we pay an enormous financial price for them.
Mm-hmm.
In taxes and, you know, in both in that and educational costs.
So you're saying that the antagonist here is our society?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Without specifically talking about the ending, same sort of thing, just... modern culture, our systems are failing, everything's going downhill. Is that what you were trying to say with it?
Yeah, you make it sound so bleak.
Well, you know, I definitely enjoyed it. I don't think bleak is bad, necessarily. Do you?
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty much what I was going for. But, speaking of the ending, the ending originally... when I tried to get it published in the U.S. after I first wrote it, the fact they wanted me to make the ending happy.
Yes.
And I'm sure you can see if you've read the book that a happy ending would have kind of made the book worthless.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have been able to make any of the points I wanted to make.
Mm-hmm.
It would have sounded like I was making the opposite of the points.
Yeah.
Like, hold on just one second. Hi. It would have just basically turned it into empty-headed fluff.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very good that it's been picked up. Bitter Lemon, I believe, is your current publisher. Yes, Bitter Lemon Press.
Wait, they're an English publisher.
Yes. So, I guess that's still ironic. You didn't actually find a U.S. publisher. You found an English language publisher. Is the book doing very well in the U.S.? Have you gotten good responses?
As far as I know, I haven't had any press.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's just prior to the election.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I imagine not. I know it did very well in France.
Mm-hmm.
The French title did well, and it's just being released in Germany, and apparently it's doing very well there. But America, not so much.
How's it doing in the UK?
How's it doing where?
In the UK?
I think it did quite well. I know it got a lot of really good reviews.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it just did fairly average.
All right. But, at least the Germans and the French and some of us over here across the lake can actually, like, read this and identify with this. And you really haven't done a whole lot of press. I thought, didn't the New York Times Book Review give you a little shiny review?
No, I don't believe they did. Oh, they've done it for Working Fist Manifesto. I've always had very good press in the New York Times for the last two books.
Ah, gotcha.
From this one, nothing.
So everyone's pretty much ignored it.
I think so.
Well, I guess I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, you know, you leave the books out there for a while, and eventually you never know what'll happen. Like, you don't have to sell a book right away. It's like, not like the movies where it actually requires being shown. All you have to do is have the book handy in a bookstore. So, and also you can always, now we got online sales, so over time, word builds, and I also think that I've got a movie coming out.
Really?
It's going to be out in like 2010, from since the layoffs.
Really?
Awesome.
Yeah, I just found out about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
And
So after that, like after the movie comes out, then people might recognize the name and then go and buy the book. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't always have to happen in the first couple of weeks.
Do you have any details about the movie?
Not yet. I only know the name of the producer.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we don't have stars lined up. We don't have anything, but what we got is financing. And it's enough financing to make it a good movie.
Well, that's terrific.
Yeah, I'll keep you informed, though.
That would be great. We'd love to have you on, unless you grow a little too big for us over here.
Never happened.
All right. Good stuff. Any new books, articles?
I'm mostly interested right now in drugs.
Gotcha.
Writing about them, that is.
Mm.
And in particular, I wanted to do something with either the drug trade,
mm-hmm,
or the disaster that's caused by our national drug policy.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I'm a big supporter of normalizing, decriminalizing marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to get that message in there. But I was actually thinking of doing that nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know a lot of people who know a lot about the subject.
Definitely.
So I wanted to write about that.
Good stuff. But we've got Proposition 1 here in Michigan this year is medical marijuana.
Yeah, isn't that just medical marijuana? Like, you have to pretend it's medical. I mean, come on.
Well, that
I don't know. What is up with that? Why can't we just say we want to smoke marijuana? Where did they get the idea that they can tell us, first of all, what we can put in our bodies? There was a time not too long ago when alcohol was illegal.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't understand. There's just a whiff of whim about all these what you can do to your body laws.
Definitely.
And so hopefully this whim is just going to go away and we can all smoke marijuana soon.
Well, it's another system. To make a callback, it's another system that seems to be failing us. It is completely arbitrary and it's legitimized, and we can give amphetamines to little kids because, well, they have energy.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I mean, I guess if it comes from Pfizer, then it's okay.
Yeah, we need some Pfizer marijuana.
Yes, indeed. So your website, I've noticed it's down. Is it coming back? Do you have plans for Ian Levison?
I might do something with it next year.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like you need so much technical knowledge.
Gotcha.
And I just wasn't in the mood to learn all that.
Gotcha.
And I couldn't seem to find anybody to help me. So yeah, I mean, and also it's kind of difficult maintaining, like I can write an interesting article every now and then, an article that I really like, and I think says something different, another, you know, it were in a different way. But it's hard to do on a regular basis. If you start pressuring yourself to write something once a week, you start just putting up a bunch of crap.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, I would like to do it. It's just difficult when you're, also when you're writing a novel. I try to use all my writing time for that.
Mm-hmm. So when you're writing, do you think that when you're writing a novel, is that easier because you're in the same story, or do you have to take breaks from that as well?
It kind of depends on where you are in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like sometimes it's just pure pleasure to write and other times it's pure torture. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's, every author is different. You know, I've talked to other writers who say that they write every day at, you know, between 6 and 8. I could never do that.
Mm-hmm.
I write pretty much when I feel like it. And I usually feel like it about twice a week. And I think if you started, like if I started doing more than that, my writing would change fundamentally. It would just become more mechanical.
Indeed.
So I don't know. It's different for everyone.
Mm-hmm. So you have no regrets about so far only having 2 novels published? You taking your time, I guess?
Well, I've actually written another novel, which I can't get published in the U.S., which is coming out this spring. And that's about, that's called The Dog Walkers, and that's about three guys who start committing crimes in a small Pennsylvania coal town.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of go on a crime spree and ultimately, of course, get caught. And the book was primarily written because I wanted to write something funny.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the people who have read it have said it's the most bitter and angry thing that I've ever written. So I guess it might be psychologically revealing on some level that I'm having some issues with publishers and whatnot. But it's a cool life, actually. I enjoy writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of fun.
As long as the art survives, you know, it if it's funny to you and there's an audience for it, and I think they are very dark, they're bleak, but they are very witty, and what they say is very biting and pertinent to today's issues. So I think, I don't know, I guess it's easy to say, well, you know, my friends tell me I'm dark, but I think that, like, there's a value to that. It's honesty, really, I think. I don't know.
I think it would probably be popular with people who listen to your show. Like, it's basically the same kind of point of view, I think.
Mm. Well, if those folks are out there. Well, thank you very much, Ian Levison. The book is Dog Eats Dog. It is, I want to say in bookstores, but that apparently is questionable. But it's available online. And Ian Levison,
I think it actually is available at Barnes and Noble.
Really?
Yeah, I accidentally came across that.
Okay, well, good.
Oh, cool.
Stuff.
That's good to hear.
So, in our Barnes and Noble?
Maybe.
So, okay, it might be available in this town, listeners out there.
Thanks very much, man.
No problem.
It.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And keep us updated on that movie. We're very excited.
Well, take care.
All right. Have a good one, and thank you very much.
See you.